dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, and Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for a tour of what I think is an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world, the war we are very much in at the moment. A man who is very well suited to give us such an intelligence briefing has spent much of his life in senior government positions, including overseeing the intelligence community on the staff of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. He is Dan Gallington, a former Air Force officer, a man who served in various other capacities, including as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, and who is now a columnist with U.S. News and World Report. Dan, it's always good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Thanks, Frank. It's always great to be here.
I hardly know where to begin, Dan. Maybe we could start with the developments that seem awfully reminiscent to some of the days in which we worked together back in the Pentagon in the Cold War. Is that what's emerging in your estimation as we look at not only Vladimir Putin's belligerence towards Ukraine, but also the ongoing and it seems increasingly aggressive modernization of Russia's nuclear forces?
Well, I think that's one conclusion. I mean, you can't forget who the guy is. He's a KGB thug, and he runs Russia under this guise of new populism. But he's really a KGB thug. That's the way he operates. Look at what he's doing. He moves in these special forces guys disguised as populists. And this is traditional kind of KGB, GRU stuff that he was raised on.
Talk a little bit, Dan, though, about the nuclear stuff, because we don't really think about these sorts of issues very much anymore in this country. We just had a flight test of a new multi-warhead intercontinental ballistic missile. There are some who think that that's a violation of the new START treaty. There certainly is another weapon that they've recently introduced that's a violation of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. Compare and contrast, if you would, Dan, that to what we're doing with respect to our own nuclear forces at the moment.
Well, you know, it's funny. You said some people think it's a violation of new START. Some people say, no, it's not. And the reason that debate is there is because we so poorly negotiated New START that the definitions essentially come from Russian positions. We've taken what the Russians wanted and incorporated it into a treaty and then drafted a bunch of goofy compliance inspection protocols. So the bottom line is the Russians are going to do what they want to with their missile force and modernize it as they had planned. We're the only ones that seem to be stopped, and the legal term is stopped by a START and our reluctance to modernize our forces. We've got ICBMs out in the Midwest and our missile fields sitting empty. I mean, this is crazy. We haven't modernized these nuclear forces for 20, 30 years.
You know, back when we were in the Pentagon together, we were building the forces that we're still living off of today. And sadly, I think most Americans, Dan Gallington, are completely oblivious to the fact that these things haven't been tested since 1992 in terms of the nuclear weapons themselves. The modernization has been non-existent on the nuclear side and limited, to say the least, in terms of their delivery systems. And it contrasts, and I'm afraid it's part of the backdrop against which this KGB thug, as you call him, is calculating what he can get away with. And I'm afraid he calculates properly. He can get away with just about anything he wants. But let me switch gears with you, Dan. I want to talk also about what the Chinese are up to at the moment. And you've been expressing concern about developments that suggest they're very seriously pursuing what I guess would be called by the military a space control capacity. Talk a bit about what that would entail and what it might mean strategically were they to accomplish it.
Well, if you look at what the president of China just said about the desirability of the militarization of space, it's basically the kind of approach that we had during the Reagan administration when we talked about how space was simply another place that we needed to have a capability to use our forces if we were attacked and if necessary. In other words, it was a place like the ocean, like the land,
theater of
like
operations,
the air, and that sort of thing. And, right, it was just simply another theater of operations. So what you're hearing from this guy is essentially a guy beating on his chest and saying, by the way, that's what we're going to be doing. We're going to be modernizing our space assets. We have an ASAT program. They've got a thing on the moon digging up moon rocks right now by automatic control. These are folks who understand the desirability of being able to exert military force in space should they need to.
Right. And Dan, what's so striking about this, again, as you will recall from your time in various capacities in the Pentagon and elsewhere in the United States government, when we were talking about space as a theater of military operations, the Chinese, as I recall, were very busily beating their chest about how it was an affront to have anybody even think about, let alone act upon, the idea of militarizing space. In fact, they've been promoting for decades a treaty to prohibit that. And it goes back to what you said earlier about our treaties with the Russians and before that the Soviet Union. It always seemed to work to stop us, but it never really seemed to make any difference in controlling their behavior. And I would assume that you would agree that that would be true in spades were we to get into some sort of nonsensical ban on militarizing space with the Chinese.
Oh, they'd love that. They would love it just like the Russians used to lecture us. You know, I was on the defense and space talks in Geneva for many years with the Russians, and they would lecture us, you know, incessantly about the evils of the militarization of space. But these guys, of course, had programs that were just behind those fake words that they were building and intended to build no matter what agreements they signed with us.
For the purpose of exercising control of space. Dan Gallington, let me take advantage of one other aspect of your career. You were, of course, not only the general counsel of the Senate Intelligence Committee, but you were the last general counsel who really served as a bipartisan figure. And we've seen a lot of partisanship lately. You've written in U.S. News and World Report about the need to fix the broken intelligence committees. This is particularly evident in light of the recent and, I guess, ongoing spat over this investigation the Democrats in the Intelligence Committee have engaged in on the so-called enhanced interrogation practices of the Bush administration. Talk a little bit about the backstory there and where you think we ought to go with these committees.
Well, it's a sad thing for me to see. And as you mentioned, I was the last bipartisan general counsel. Bob Kerry, from senator from Nebraska, a Medal of Honor winner, Democrat, Senator Shelby from Alabama, Republican, they both embraced me and let me do my work over there unfettered by any kind of politics. That was a great committee. We functioned extremely well. But in the last dozen years or so, the committee has just fallen apart. It's become typically political as any other committee on the Hill. And the media is kind of complicit in this. You know, Feinstein gets on the floor in the Senate and talks about the investigation she's running. Well, she didn't mention that it was a totally Democratic staff investigation. And that we never used to do that. We would always do bipartisan investigations. So our findings would be, would be carried out by the administration no matter which party it was.
Talk quickly about the enhanced interrogation techniques and where you think we ought to go on that.
It's one of those things they never should have done. It's one of those things that was so close to the edge of legality, and it was so carefully worded, and the legal opinions were so sharply. It was something done right on the edge of the word torture, and it only had the intention of the interrogators that separated it from torture. You add that to the fact that you're depending on accurate, truthful reports from the field. you're depending on the aggressive oversight. And how about the suggestion, oh, by the way, we want to burn these videotapes we have of enhanced interrogation. Holy cow. If that isn't an indication that it was
something was not right,
a program that was doomed.
Dan, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid, for the moment. But there's much more to talk about. We'll look forward to doing so with you again in the very near future. Thank you for your service to our country, past and present and continuing. Keep it up. We'll talk with you, as I say, very soon. Next up, a former senior official in the Department of Homeland Security talks about cyber warfare and the threat it poses to all of us. Straight ahead.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
On August 2nd, 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
Debbie Lee became a Gold Star mom that day.
And it started a lifelong mission of her own. In Mark's honor, Debbie founded America's Mighty Warriors,
dedicated to supporting the troops and their families.
AMW educates the public through speaking engagements, rallies, and events to raise awareness and appreciation of our military.
AMW advocates for the troops.
Funding, rules of engagement, benefits. AMW is committed to being a voice for justice for our troops. AMW serves Gold Star families. Retreats, concerts, special events.
Good things to remind the families they're not forgotten.
America's Mighty Warriors.
Nonprofit.
Dedicated to the troops and their families.
Donations are tax deductible.
Log on to americasmightywarriors.org.
Find out how you can help.
The best of America deserves our best. Log on today.
americasmightywarriors.org.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.americanfreedomlawcenter.org.
If you don't know where Bill Bennett stands, here are some of his beliefs.
I believe Americans should largely do much more for themselves than many Americans are doing.
But do I rule out government as something that might be able to assist in that? And that I do not.
I do think families, churches, and schools are better places for that to happen. People should do for themselves what they can. Government should do what people cannot do for themselves.
Get to know Bill Bennett, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by an old friend and much admired colleague, Chuck Brooks. He formerly served in a number of capacities in both the legislative and executive branches of our government, in the first instance as a senior legislative aide for
Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter, subsequently as the Director of Legislative Affairs at the Department of Homeland Security. Today, he is the Vice President and Client Executive for the Department of Homeland Security at Xerox Corporation, and very welcome as a guest. Chuck, nice to have you with us. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on, Frank. Really appreciate it.
You have developed over the years considerable expertise on matters involving cyber warfare and cybersecurity. And of course, this is very much on the minds of people in the homeland security business. Talk a little bit about the extent of the problem we're facing at the moment, Chuck, in terms of enemies of this country who are waging cyber war against us.
Yeah, cybersecurity has really evolved and probably the number one issue for the Department of Homeland Security and for, you know, federal government in general. What has happened is we've become transformed into a very interconnected digital world where we are much more vulnerable as we are more interconnected. So what has happened is most of the private sector is not prepared, particularly industries such as utilities, nuclear, communications, et cetera, and they're just now trying to catch up and patch vulnerabilities, work on malware software, et cetera. But it's sort of a response to the threat rather than being proactive. And recently, the Department of Homeland Security has been taking the initiative, actually via presidential order and OPM, to be the lead agency in civilian to work on this. And their first realization is that they had no coordination with the private sector and there's no understanding of the real vulnerabilities. So it's really a work in progress.
Yeah, steep learning curve. And just as a matter of context, it is said that the United States government's computers, those in industry and others, are in the aggregate attacked millions of times per day by cyber enemies of this country. We're visiting with Chuck Brooks. He is today a senior executive in the Xerox Corporation, responsible for its relationship with the Department of Homeland Security, among other matters. He has spent time in the belly of the beast as well over at DHS. And Chuck, we're talking a little bit about the learning curve that the federal government has to mount in terms of getting its arms around the nature of the cyber warfare threat, let alone what can be done proactively to deal with it. An example of this that I think is on a lot of people's minds in the public at the moment is, of course, this so-called Heartbleed bug or whatever it is, virus vulnerability maybe is the best way to describe it. Talk a little bit about it as a symptom of the challenges that we're facing in trying to maintain secure transactions and communications and the like on the internet.
Yeah, well, you know, we are a free society, and this is basically open code, an open SSL version that was found to have vulnerabilities. And you know, there's a lot of similarities between, you know, viral health and computer health. There's a lot of bugs and malware out there. And sometimes we find them after the fact and we look at patches to correct them. In this case, it appears that most of the activities with Heartbleed can be sort of rectified as with new patches, with new certificates, with changing passwords. But there are a lot more threatening and ominous activities out there, like such as denial of service, hacking into utilities, state-sponsored stealing of secrets, and, of course, cybercrime, which is identity theft, which happened recently with Target and with some other major retailers. So we live in a very vulnerable atmosphere where, you know, we're always looking to fix the last problem. And it's similar to pretty much the way security and wars are fought, too. We're always looking at the last problem. And I think one of the issues with cybersecurity, after we look forward, and what new technologies will be put in place to harden sites so we're not all soft targets, how we do protocols to communicate and alert everybody. Information sharing is a really key aspect of cybersecurity, because otherwise you don't know what malware is out there or who's been attacked. And part of the reluctance is that the private sector doesn't always like to talk to each other, let alone government. And so what's happening now is with these voluntary NIST standards supported by Department of Homeland Security, there's a lot of meetings going on where the private sector and public sector get together to do voluntary standards, not regulations, but basically look at ways where they can preempt and coordinate resilience should such attacks do occur.
Speaking of attacks, Chuck, a different kind of attack took place, as you know, exactly 1 year ago today in a major what's called a transformer substation outside of San Jose, California. It's a reminder that these installations, which there are thousands across the country, that are really the backbone of the electric grid, are vulnerable to various kinds of attacks. According to the Bipartisan Policy Center here in Washington, as you may know, they recently issued a report, I think the end of February, in which they said that the frequency and sophistication of cyber attacks against the electric grid, not to be confused with the physical kind that happened at this Metcalf substation, but of a virtual kind, I guess you would say, but they could have very real physical consequences in terms of the destruction of these essentially irreplaceable transformers, high energy transformers. I say essentially irreplaceable in that it takes a long time to get replacements in. How serious a problem do you think that particular form of cyber warfare, that particular target set, I guess I should say, for cyber warriors, represents in this country and to its people?
I think it's very serious. You know, first of all, they're soft targets, as you mentioned. There has not been enough money and resources dedicated by the utilities over the years to keep up with the threats and the sort of catching up. And when one of these incidents does happen, and several have been attempted, the implications are catastrophic. So if you're looking at terrorism, or if you're looking at just something as a nuisance, this is just a horribly vulnerable area that the United States has to really focus on in the cybersecurity arena.
Yeah. And as you say, the challenge here is to be thinking proactively and taking actions in a sort of forward-looking fashion, fixing the grid after it's been taken down, let alone restoring the country that depends critically upon it, I think is really not an option. And on this anniversary of the attack in San Jose, we're mindful of that. We had a program earlier in the day in which we really brought some of the best minds together to talk about what needs to be done in this space. And Chuck, we appreciate your work at the Department of Homeland Security and now at Xerox to help in this regard, among others. Finally, you've been focusing a lot, I know, Chuck, on, again, our guest is Chuck Brooks, now with Xerox Corporation, on social media, social networks, and the vulnerabilities that they may have to cyber malice. Talk a little bit about that and specifically what individuals should be thinking about as they use these networks.
Yeah, certainly. Well, first of all, you know, social media has really consumed America and even the world in the last few years. Pretty much 95% of executives and government officials are on social media. So they're easy targets to get your information, find out vulnerabilities, particularly for things like identity theft. But there are also, there's been malware and other things planted on websites. A first course for anyone using social media would, again, be to often change your passwords. Secondly, don't disclose anything that's personal and private that can be used against you. And also, there's some sort of social mores. If you're working for a company or working for a government, you don't want to necessarily disclose some of the sensitive activities you're doing for your work, too. So those are the basics.
They are the basics indeed, and they make eminent sense, as you always do. Chuck Brooks, thank you very much for joining us. I hope we'll be able to consult with you with regularity about this very important problem and the need to be thinking in an outside-of-the-box fashion about it, not simply reacting to the latest crisis. Keep up the good work, my friend. Come back to us again very soon.
Thank you, Frank.
Next up, we'll talk with Claire Lopez, taking stock on the Islamists' civilization jihad. Are they winning? Straight ahead.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
If you don't know where Bill Bennett stands, here are some of his beliefs.
I believe Americans should largely do much more for themselves than many Americans are doing.
But do I rule out government as something that might be able to assist in that? And that I do not.
I do think families, churches, and schools are better places for that to happen. People should do for themselves what they can. Government should do what people cannot do for themselves.
Get to know Bill Bennett, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Ginny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. New Yorkers already have buyer's remorse about their radical new mayor, Bill de Blasio. That unhappiness may soon turn to alarm, however. The mayor's choice to head the NYPD, former Commissioner William Bratton, has just shut down a program used for over a decade to conduct legal undercover surveillance of Muslim mosques, community centers, and other potential incubators of jihadism. A Bratton spokesman says, quote, "In the future, the police will gather that information if necessary through direct contact between the police precinct and the representatives of the communities they serve," unquote. In other words, from now on, NYPD will be reduced to asking for tips about jihadists from self-appointed representatives of Muslim Americans who just happen to be adherents to Sharia and the jihad it commands. Care to bet your life on that arrangement? This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Claire Lopez, a career intelligence officer with the CIA. Now in from the cold, she works with us at the Center for Security Policy, where she has just become, I'm very pleased to say, our Vice President for Research and Analysis. Claire is one of the duty experts on matters involving Islamism, and there is a lot going on in that part of the battle space at the moment, so we're delighted to catch up with her. Claire, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. Glad to be with you.
There's so much to talk about at the moment in this, as I say, portfolio. Claire, talk a little bit about what we are to make of, well, what seems to be a really stunning degree of information dominance by these jihadists here in the United States, not just elsewhere. And maybe we could start with the silencing of Ayaan Hirsi Ali at Brandeis University recently and the effort to suppress a film that she's been involved with on her diaries. What do you make of that?
Well, yes, exactly. Ayaan Hirsi Ali, of course, is the Somali woman who herself was subjected to female genital mutilation, was headed for a forced marriage when she escaped and went to Europe, wound up becoming a member of parliament in the Dutch parliament, author of two highly acclaimed books, Nomad and Infidel, and recently was to be awarded an honorary doctorate at Brandeis University, and she was to have given the commencement speech there this spring. And under pressure from groups like CARE, Council on American Islamic Relations, and others, Brandeis University caved, and they withdrew the offer, withdrew her invitation, and she will not be receiving the doctorate or speaking there.
And what was the justification for this? Surely it wasn't that Brandeis found objectionable her warnings about how women's rights were being infringed upon, or worse, their bodies mutilated by these Islamists. Could that possibly be the case? A university with a tradition of, in the Jewish spectrum most especially, of commitment to personal freedoms and liberty, could that have actually been what happened here?
Well, I mean, you would certainly think that they would be entirely in sync with and sympathetic to the message that Ayaan Hirsi Ali has so bravely been speaking for all these many years against the oppression of women inside Islamic societies under Islamic law. But no, quite to the contrary, they apparently feared the backlash, again, from organizations like Hamas fronts like CARE, other Muslim Brotherhood front groups applying pressure, and the fact that she has been very outspoken against Islamic practices which are completely justified and condoned and even obligated under Islamic law, like female genital mutilation.
Yeah, this is the Sharia doctrine. Claire Lopez, let me turn to another topic. Of course, yesterday was the one-year anniversary of the attack by two of these Islamists, the Sarnaev brothers, on innocent people, runners, bystanders, and so on, at the Boston Marathon. Have you been struck, as I have, by the curious elimination from the reporting on this event and the commemoration of it a year later as to the motives of these individuals and their connections to, among other things, the Islamic Society of Boston Mosque in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where apparently they got a fair measure of their so-called radicalization, imbuing them with both Sharia and the jihadist commands?
Yes, you know, Frank, just as you say, I have been struck by these commemorations, which of course were beautiful and a testament to the survivors and also the victims. And all of that was well and as it should be. But you're right, the names of the Tsarnaev brothers, their affiliation with Islamic jihad, their potential, the older brother Tamerlane's potential connections to jihadist groups over in the Caucasus, where he spent 6 months in the first part of the year 2012, all of this has been shoved aside. All of this has been put aside. It is right to celebrate the lives of those who were injured and killed. That is right. But to completely and deliberately, it seems, and it does seem deliberate attempt to submerge the affiliation of the Tsarnaev brothers, as you say, with the mosque, the Islamic Center there in Boston, but as well their connections with the jihadist groups over in the Caucasus, in Dagestan, perhaps in Chechnya. All of that has been shoved to the side. And it does seem deliberate, and it is a loss of focus on the enemy that brought this tragedy to Boston. It is It is a failure to focus on the continuing, and this is continuing, and that's the point, continuing jihad against the United States, because it will happen again unless we understand where this came from and why.
Yeah. Well, that brings us to the next point. Failure indeed. We've just heard that the New York Police Department, Claire Lopez of the Center for Security Policy, the New York Police Department has just decided they are going to disband a unit of the NYPD that had been engaged in surveillance, undercover, legal, but nonetheless covert surveillance of the Muslim community in New York and the surrounding area, looking for precisely the kinds of activities or individuals and associations that had the Sarnaev boys been more closely monitored, might have prevented them from being able to execute this kind of attack. What do you make, Claire, as a former intelligence professional, of this decision and the possible repercussions it might have for the people of New York and who knows beyond?
Well, you know, again, Frank, you're right to be including this topic in our discussion this morning because it seems of a piece. And it seems of the same sort of theme that organizations which should be on the alert and on the offensive against these manifestations of Islamic Jihad coming to our shores, these very organizations, including perhaps what is the premier police force in the United States, the New York Police Department, capitulating to pressure. And this is after a federal court judge found the New York Police Department actions entirely legal. And again, it's not even precisely surveillance that they were doing. It was rather, I heard it described by a former intelligence official last night as human terrain mapping. In other words, what they were doing was trying to identify communities, where they lived, who was involved there, who were the leaderships of the communities, such that if a tip were to come from, let's say, intelligence sources about an impending attack or a jihadist cell, they would know where to go. They would know where to look to talk to local community members and leaders. So it wasn't even surveillance per se, but it was rather becoming acquainted and becoming familiar with this neighborhood or these neighborhoods and groups from which we have to admit attackers, Islamic jihadists, have arisen in the past, and in particular New York City, which remains a top target.
Indeed it does. Claire Lopez, we just have less than a minute left. Very quickly, one of the groups that has been actively seeking to restrict our what the military would call situational awareness in just the fashion that you've talked about, as well as our ability to counter these jihadists, is a group known as the Islamic Society of North America, an unindicted co-conspirator in the Holy Land Foundation trial. They are now campaigning on behalf of something called Safe Spaces, which would basically preclude, if adopted by the government, and it sounds like the New York Police Department is well on its way, this idea that mosques must not be put under surveillance. Informants must not be allowed to be admitted to them. Very quickly, what do you make of that? Advisable?
What a coup. What a coup for the jihadists. If the purge of United States government training throughout the government about the connection between Islamic doctrine, law, scripture, history, and Islamic terrorism had not occurred, they would be able to study and to understand that the use of mosques going back to the time of Muhammad has been precisely not just as a center of prayer and worship, but also a center of command and control for jihad operations. To put that off limits is foolhardy in the extreme.
It is indeed. Claire Lopez, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you so much for the terrific work you do. We're delighted to have you with us as a vice president of the Center for Security Policy for Research and Analysis. We'll look forward to visiting with you on the air again very soon. Next up, Roger Noriega joins us to talk about the most dangerous region in the world, in our front yard, straight ahead.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
There is a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them,
when you make fun of them,
when you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around. And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
This is Frank Gaffney. Something is seriously wrong when the FBI interviews a jihadist like Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older of the two Chechens believed to have perpetrated the bombing of the Boston Marathon, and sees no evil. Yet, that is the predictable result of the shackling of the Bureau that has taken place in recent years. For example, in 2011, the Obama administration actually purged FBI training materials of information that warns of the connection between the Tsarnaev's kind of religious fervor and terrifying acts of jihad. And Team Obama has also effectively told the Bureau it must get the approval of Muslim Brotherhood operatives before it can do any such training in the future. This is a formula for much more jihad in America. It's time to free the FBI so that they can do their job and protect our country. If you agree, go to www.freethefbi.com. That's www.freethefbi.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Roger Noriega, the man we consult with regularity about what is happening in Latin America and elsewhere in our hemisphere. He is our duty expert on the subject by virtue of his considerable experience with it in official capacities, notably as Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs and also as the U.S. Ambassador to the Organization of American States. Roger is currently a visiting fellow with the American Enterprise Institute and a driving force behind invaluable web resource called InterAmericanSecurityWatch.com. Roger, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us, sir.
Thank you for the opportunity, Frank.
You are, I'm sure, not surprised by a finding by the United Nations, but it is nonetheless striking that Latin America has now achieved the dubious distinction of being the most dangerous region in the world, as measured by murders conducted against its people. Talk a little bit about that state of affairs, Roger, as a kind of backdrop for everything else we want to talk with you about today.
Well, according to the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, countries like Honduras, El Salvador, Venezuela have eclipsed African countries that used to lead the way in this ignominious statistic on the number of deaths per 100,000, homicides per 100,000. Venezuela's rate doubled, for example, to 53 per 100,000. El Salvador was at 41%. And they attribute 40% of these murders to international organized crime driven by the drug traffic. The problem we have as Americans is that our demand fuels this mayhem, and our administration just is not paying a significant amount of attention or investing the resources to help these countries fight this problem.
One of the places where we are still investing some resources, but with uncertain effect, especially against the backdrop of what is now being done by the government to normalize relations with one of the narco-trafficking cartels down there, a terrorist group, really, the FARC, is in Colombia. Talk a little bit about what's going on there, what U.S. policy is towards that country, and the advisability of these negotiations with some of the most dangerous people in the hemisphere.
Well, it's interesting that those same statistics point to Colombia as a country where the number of deaths per 100,000 actually dropped. It's still very high. The problem is that the government there is seeking a political agreement with a narco-terrorist group and negotiating the, you know, socioeconomic terms to get this criminal organization to supposedly end its aggression and its war against the Colombian state. Unfortunately, this has been endorsed by the United States and most countries in the region that apparently are turning a blind eye to the FARC's involvement in international crime and murder that reaches up across the U.S. border and has direct consequences for the well-being of the American people. And this is a political accord that will be very, very costly to a lot of countries that are threatened by this narco-trafficking organization.
And one of the aspects of the deal that apparently is taking shape, I think they're holding fairly close the details, but it sounds as though one of the requirements on the part of the government will be to cease the effort to suppress the cultivation of cocoa, the root of cocaine, by the various kind of herbicides that are typically sprayed on fields where these things are grown. Talk a little bit about, again, what that would mean for the hemisphere as well as for us if we were essentially to allow this kind of drug cultivation to go on unchecked.
Well, essentially, it's an industrial cultivation of legal narcotics. And if you don't have that fumigation in a country like Colombia with its topography, it's going to be impossible to stay ahead of the curve of this threat. And the narcos know that. This is not a political organization, a revolutionary organization. It's a business. It's a business in the dirtiest kinds of crime and the worst illicit trafficking. And, it's a shame that the government of Colombia is turning a blind eye to this, and the United States is abetting this very irresponsible policy.
Yeah, it's more than a shame. I'm afraid it's a peril to us as well as to others in the region.
Absolutely.
Roger, speaking of which, one of the things that we're seeing reportedly, given the openness of our border at the moment, is an upsurge in what are called OTMs, other than Mexican illegal immigrants. Some of those, of course, that are particularly worrying are those that are coming in from, the Middle East, and some of the African countries that you've alluded to are pretty dangerous places as well. But some of them are coming from elsewhere in our hemisphere. What seems to be impelling this upsurge in illegal immigration from other than Mexicans?
Well, a lot of it is from Central America, a region that's whose economy is undermined by criminality, driven by this narco-trafficking and the activity of gangs that are actually involved in the narco-trafficking and crime. And in El Salvador, we had recent elections, you and I have discussed this, of a regime that has made a pact with the narcos and made a pact with the street gangs, including MS-13, that threatened directly the well-being of the American people. So you see, and for example, a 55% increase in the apprehension of people from those Central American countries that are destabilized by narco-trafficking coming across our southwest border. And my concern is that as these groups become more powerful, particularly in alliance with the governments, they're going to decimate the economic well-being of those countries and make it impossible for those people to make a living, and that will drive up the pressure on illegal immigration.
Yeah, it's deeply troubling, needless to say, and at a moment when we still see people talking about leaving the border effectively open, it is almost certainly going to mean that we're going to have more of this inflow, not just of people seeking economic opportunity, but also of some dubious characters as well. Roger, let me turn to Venezuela. We've been covering it with your help fairly closely for a while now. What is the latest in terms of the so-called dialogue that has been taking place between the government and the opposition? Has it amounted to anything, or was it really just smoke and mirrors for external consumption?
Well, it's really both, I guess, is the answer to that question, because there was sort of a dramatic development in that the leader of the sort of official opposition, I guess you would call it now, has agreed to a truth commission with the government, has agreed to sort of call on the pacification of the country, which is kind of an eerie term when you're dealing with an authoritarian government. But that has tended to, or appears to undercut the street protests, which the students say they're going to continue and which many in the opposition say must continue if we're going to get real change. What this amounts to is dialogue so far, which is now being held in secret, by the way, and not in public, is treating the symptoms and not the disease, which will eventually overcome a regime that's bankrupt, that's lost all legitimacy. But it's a very interesting development and one that's going to have to be watched very carefully. What worries me is that the United States is behind this kind of Band-Aid approach. We're endorsing this dialogue, and which will not solve the real problems that the Venezuelan people are confronting.
Yeah, Roger Noriega of the American Enterprise Institute, now and formerly the Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs. I must say, I fear that what you've just described is really a formula for the pacification of the opposition and not anything remotely like the kind of structural change and reform that's required to spare the Venezuelan people, as well as the rest of us in the region and beyond, the kind of predations that the Chavismo team has brought us. Keep your eye on it. Roger, please keep coming back to us with updates on this and everything else that we need to be mindful of in this very important part of the world, indeed a very important and dangerous part of the world. We hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affley. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.